describe it. But I think probably listening to this, you think, well, I don't really care about how you describe it. I want to know the reality, what's actually happening. And the UK government are saying they're sort of pulling on the levers they can of influence. But the big debate is who are we influencing? Who do we have the sort of power and sway over to shape any of what's happening in the Gulf?
Well, you can hear some answers from Yvette Cooper at 7 o'clock. I'll be back tomorrow. Andrew Wright's been the technical operator. Stay here for Times Radio Breakfast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Tom, and good morning. It is 6 o'clock. This is Rosie Wright and Callum McDonald with Times Radio Breakfast.
Good morning. The headlines. Vice President Vance says Iran shouldn't let peace negotiations fall apart over a misunderstanding. And the Bank of England says many shops will introduce surge pricing in the coming months.
Ahead, we'll be in Lebanon. What chance is there of Israel stopping its attacks on Hezbollah to gain a wider peace settlement? And are some owners making their pets sick?
It's Thursday, the 9th of April.
This is Times Radio.
First of the news, here's Stuart Willie.
Rosie, thank you. Good morning. Iran has accused the United States and Israel of breaking the ceasefire and is warning it may not continue with talks. It's after Israel launched a huge wave of strikes across Lebanon. Officials in Beirut say 254 people were killed and more than 1,000 injured. In response, Hezbollah fired rockets into northern Israel overnight, while Tehran says the Strait of Hormuz remains closed. The price of oil rose again overnight. US Vice President J.D. Vance is due to take part in peace talks in Pakistan on Saturday. He says the talks shouldn't fall apart over a misunderstanding.
I think the Iranians thought that the ceasefire included Lebanon, and it just didn't. We never made that promise. We never indicated that was going to be the case. What we said is that the ceasefire would be focused on Iran, and the ceasefire would be focused on America's allies, both Israel and the Gulf Arab states.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump says U.S. military ships, aircraft and troops will stay in the region until the deal is fully complied with. In a social media post, he warned that, in his words, shooting starts if the agreement is breached. Sir Keir Starmer is continuing his tour of the Middle East today. He met with the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as part of ongoing talks with allies aimed at giving commercial shipping the confidence to pass through the Strait of Hormuz. A Downing Street spokesperson says the UK's efforts with its partners to reopen the strait remain vital. Elsewhere, the Bank of England says shoppers are likely to see more dynamic pricing in stores this year. It says one in three retailers plan to use what it calls market-responsive pricing tools, allowing prices to be adjusted according to demand using algorithms and electronic shelf displays. Campaigners fear that could lead to a surge pricing and are calling for tighter regulation of the grocery sector. The French government has rejected a proposal from Shabana Mahmoud to deploy British Border Force vessels to intercept small boats and return them to France. The Home Secretary put forward the option as part of negotiations to renew the multi-million pound migrant deal during an impasse in talks. A woman nicknamed the Ketamine Queen has been jailed for 15 years for selling Matthew Perry the drugs that killed him. The Friends actor died of an overdose in October 2023. 42-year-old Jasveen Sangha pleaded guilty to 5 charges last September. The actor's stepfather, Keith Morrison, spoke outside court.
You have to have a heart of stone to wake up every morning and make a business out of feeding off the addictions of vulnerable people. Then when you're forced to, you know, confront what you have done, if you don't feel some sense of shame or sorrow, then you're not even human.
And a person's genes could predict how effective weight loss jabs are and whether people are more likely to suffer side effects. That's according to a study published in the journal Nature. Seanad Quirk is an obesity dietitian.
This is another step in us being able to maximise the efficiency of which drug to use for what person, really being able to provide patient-centred care. So this is an exciting prospect to be able to really maximise our outcomes for patients.
For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio news briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide.
Hello, good morning. It's 4 minutes past six on Thursday morning, the 9th of April. Welcome to Times Radio Breakfast with Rosie Wright and Callum MacDonald, while Kate McCann and Stig Abel are on their holidays. It was never going to be easy, and possibly everyone predicted it would be almost exactly this hard. It turns out that declaring a ceasefire on social media is not quite the same thing as having actually determined and agreed the principles and parameters of how the ceasefire should function. Are the US, Israel and Iran serious about stopping the bombing? President Trump has pivoted to peace through negotiation and has his vice president lined up to lead talks in Pakistan tomorrow. He'll be taking part as accusations fly that the ceasefire is being violated, that it was constructed on lies in the first place, and that the starting positions of each side are many miles apart. The Strait of Hormuz is far from fully open, Lebanon is still under attack, and a return to all-out conflict sadly remains possible. We'll be live in Lebanon in the next few minutes. You'll also hear from the Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, live on this programme just after 7 o'clock.
The Times this morning reports that we'll feel worse off for up to 6 months, even if the ceasefire holds, although interest rates may not rise as had been feared. Experts say the impact of supply chain disruptions will be felt acutely for months to come. The average price of diesel is over 190 pence per litre. That's gone up 34% since the 28th of February, the outset of this war. The Bank of England's also warning that supermarkets may be introducing dynamic pricing this year to change the prices of goods based on demand. One in three companies plan to use dynamic pricing. In shops, that could mean at the time of day, how busy the store is, or what the weather is like, could mean rapidly changing prices.
Quite a thing, that. Also on Breakfast this morning, the Liberal Democrat who invented the state pension triple lock, and why there's political consensus for it keeping on going up and up and up. And the Conservative Shadow Foreign Secretary Dame Priti Patel joins us later as well.
And you can WhatsApp us this morning. Any questions you have for the Foreign Secretary? Any questions you have about the current status of the ceasefire? You can WhatsApp us 0333 003 2353. Text us on 87222. Start your message with the word Times. Or you can also email our producer Emma on studio@times.radio.
So it can be hard to create a solid international agreement, even when made by friendly nations with open communications. So it isn't surprising that the ceasefire deal between Iran and America is under terrific strain already. The two countries have been at odds since 1979, and many leaders of the Iranian regime have been killed by American and Israeli strikes over the last 6 weeks.
The big dividing issue at the moment appears to be Lebanon. Vice President J.D. Vance explained the American perspective as he was about to leave Hungary on Air Force Two to head towards those talks in Pakistan.
I think the Iranians thought that the ceasefire included Lebanon, and it just didn't. We never made that promise. We never indicated that was going to be the case. What we said is that the ceasefire would be focused on Iran, and the ceasefire would be focused on America's allies, both Israel and the Gulf Arab states. Now, that said, the Israelis, as I understand it, again, I'm supposed to get a fuller report when I get on the plane, have actually offered to be, frankly, to check themselves a little bit in Lebanon because they want to make sure that our negotiation is successful.
So, will the Israelis check themselves? Let's hear a translation of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu talking before J.D. Vance about those attacks on Lebanon.
We still have some goals to accomplish, and we will achieve these goals either through agreement and consensus or through renewal of the war, because we are ready to do so whenever necessary. Our finger is on the trigger.
Well, Hunter Williamson is a reporter joining us from Beirut. Hunter, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's good to speak to you. First of all, just tell us, how is it there? Has Lebanon been attacked overnight?
Yes, there were a couple of attacks on Beirut, which you can see behind me, overnight. But yesterday saw some of the heaviest bombing of Lebanon since the start of the war between Hezbollah and Israel last month on March 2nd. Israel carried out over 100 airstrikes across the country, and what it said was its largest attack yet.
So there is no sign of a ceasefire there, and there is debate about whether Lebanon was even considered, I suppose, really, as part of this ceasefire in the first place.
Correct. So the Israelis, shortly after the announcement of the ceasefire, There was a statement from the office of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu stating that the ceasefire did not apply to Lebanon. The Israeli military followed up on that statement some hours later, saying that it was going to continue its fight against Hezbollah. And then the massive attack was carried out across the country. Here in Beirut, several areas were targeted. Residential buildings where Israel claimed that Hezbollah had command and control centers, military infrastructure, other things to that effect. Israel leveled buildings across the city, even in some areas that previously had not been targeted before.
Wow. So when it comes to the targeting, the motivation here is targeting Hezbollah, a proxy of Iran. To what extent are civilians being affected?
Civilians are being extremely impacted by this. So what Israel alleges, what Israel claims, is that Hezbollah basically has, as I mentioned, command and control centers, military weapon systems, things to this effect that they're storing in residential areas, residential buildings. Last night, I went to one such residential building that Israel targeted. This was, a typical several-story apartment building. And Israel, according to Israeli media, there was someone linked to Hezbollah that Israel was trying to target in this building. But this building was full of civilian people. I was watching first responders trying to rescue people from the rubble, from the destroyed apartment buildings. I saw three people in particular that they were able to rescue. But there were many others who were not so lucky. Another building that I went to, I saw a young man crying right next to the rubble. And he walked over to me and my colleagues and told us that he said that several of his family members were still under the rubble. He had only survived because he was at work. He said that if I had been here, I would have been killed too.
Gosh. When it comes then, I suppose, Hunter, to the geopolitical situation here, can you help us understand why Israel seems to be intent on striking Lebanon when there may be a ceasefire, a tentative one, as it is, in the wider region? What is it that keeps Israel targeting Lebanon in this way?
Yeah, so there's a lot of speculation and analysis that's been coming out about this. There are some experts and analysts that say that Israel actually wanted to continue the war against Iran. They didn't want the U.S. to reach this ceasefire agreement with them. And they saw that by continuing its military campaign here in Lebanon, they could upend the ceasefire, knowing that Iran likely would not stand by idly as their ally Hezbollah here in Lebanon was getting bombed. So there's some speculation about that. On another level, Israel and Hezbollah have been enemies for decades. Mm-hmm. Israel has long described Hezbollah as one of its primary threats. And it has seemed very intent during this war for the past month that it wants to deliver a very decisive blow to Hezbollah. So there may just also be an element of the Israelis wanting to really try and take out Hezbollah in a moment where they see they have the chance to. Even though that is borderline impossible, a lot of people would argue that Hezbollah cannot be defeated militarily, but this still might be an objective or a goal of the Israelis.
And I suppose one of the other dynamics about how Hezbollah operates in Lebanon is that while they may be an armed group, they're also involved in the infrastructure of the country.
Yes. So this is something that I think there's a lot of nuance to this. So for us in the West, when we hear Hezbollah being described as a terrorist organization, we immediately sort of think of groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda. We get this idea of these shadowy underground figures carrying out suicide bombings all over the place. But Hezbollah is very much a huge part of Lebanese society and the Lebanese fabric. Hezbollah has more than just its military branch. It also has a political branch. It has branches in social services, taking care of hospitals, schools, especially in southern Lebanon. I mean, it's been a huge part of the Shia community here in Lebanon. Lebanon is a country composed of more than a dozen different religious sects, entailing Christians, Sunni Muslims, Shia Muslims, Druze, Alawites. And for the Shia community, who make up about a third of the Lebanese population, Hezbollah, through its political and social services, has been really critical and essential in helping this community.
So it's a difficult and intractable issue. Hunter, thank you so much. Thank you for your reporting. We'll catch up again soon.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. That is Hunter Williamson reporting this morning from Beirut.
Yeah, and that so much confusion there between Iran, Israel, and the US's perspective of what this ceasefire actually entails and whether Lebanon is part of it or not. It's so shocking there to hear that actually the last 24 hours, the most intense bombardment since the war began, the 24 hours after the ceasefire was announced. Do you think for those people that was a moment of hope for them? And we talked a lot yesterday about this moment of relief across the region, but not for those residents in Lebanon. We'll speak to Yvette Cooper a little bit later in 45 minutes or so and ask really her analysis of what a ceasefire actually means in practice. But there's another important line from the conversations around the war. President Trump has again accused allies of letting down the United States and revived fears over the future of Greenland following the meeting that he had yesterday with NATO's Secretary General.
Yeah, the White House said it was considering leaving the alliance after accusing member nations of not providing adequate support for the war in Iran.
Well, Trump met the NATO chief, that's Mark Rutte, at the White House on Wednesday. Afterwards, Donald Trump posted a message on social media.
And this is all in capital letters, by the way. NATO wasn't there when we needed them, and they won't be there if we need them again. Remember Greenland, that big, poorly run piece of ice with three exclamation marks.
Remember back at the beginning of this year, Trump made threats to annex Greenland, an autonomous territory of Denmark. It suggests that Donald Trump also can have his attention caught, can't he, and be distracted and then revisit Greenland, who that conversation starts again today. There's lots for us to get into over the course of the next few hours. Should we have a quick look at what else is going on today in the Times and elsewhere? The Times is reporting that the Green Party leader, Zach Polanski, will promise rent controls and a crackdown on private housing developers to win votes in local elections. An internal memo to campaigners seen by the Times reveals that the injustice of the housing market, says the Green Party, was the most significant driver of anger towards Labour. Zach Polanski's party are targeting Labour-run councils across London, including Lambeth, Islington, Southwark and Hackney.
I wonder if rent controls have ever been demonstrably worked anywhere. There's a sort of like short-term sugar rush when it comes to rent controls, but in the long term, I'm not sure they have the desired effect. But I'm open to reviewing the evidence. Anyway, the French have rejected the Home Secretary's proposal to deploy British Border Force ships to intercept small boats and return them to France. Shabana Mahmood put forward the options as part of negotiations to renew the multi-million pound migrant patrol deal, which has seen progress stall in the past few weeks. As the weather improves, crossings are increasing again, with more than 100 migrants believed to have made the trip across the Channel yesterday, taking the total arrivals for this year up to more than 5,000. The Times Home Affairs editor Matt Dathan's been following the story.
This would be quite a landmark change in the operational activity in the Channel, because at the moment they only do so in British waters, and we've seen lots of the images of the Border Force cutters waiting for migrants on the 12-mile water line while they pick up migrants from the dinghies. But the French negotiators have rejected this proposal, and the impasse in the talks continues.
We'll be speaking more about this with John Vine, a former independent chief inspector of borders and immigration, in an hour's time at 7:20.
So the idea there was that it would be British Border Force ships in French waters who would intercept the ships and send them back to France, rather than doing so when you get much further over to the Channel. The Telegraph reports today, the photograph is pretty stark, that a Russian warship has staged a provocative transit through the English Channel, mocking the Prime Minister. The Admiral Grigorovich was tracked by the Royal Navy while escorting two Russian tankers through the Channel, but was left completely unchallenged as it's made its journey back to Russia. The Prime Minister, you'll remember this, recently said the Navy would seize those sanctioned vessels. The state of the Royal Navy continues to come under heavy criticism. Britain is yet now to seize a single Russian vessel since the Prime Minister gave the orders last month. And in the Middle East, it is a pretty familiar story. HMS Dragon, the destroyer sent to the region, arrived weeks after the Iran war started and is now docked due to water supply issues.
The Pope may not return to the US as long as Donald Trump remains president after a contentious meeting between a Catholic official and the Pentagon. The American website The Free Press reports that the relationship became strained after Pope Leo's annual address in January, where he criticised leaders seeking conflict around the world. In what's being described as an unprecedented move, the Pentagon held a meeting with Pope Leo's personal envoy to the US and strongly criticised Leo's comments, describing them as hostile attacks on Trump's policies.
And Donald Trump was initially quite pleased that they were going to have an American pope for the first time, but that has not helped with relations, it appears. Now, the ketamine queen has been sentenced to 15 years in federal prison for supplying the fatal dose that led to the death of the Friends star Matthew Perry. Jasmine Shanga operated a distribution hub from her North Hollywood home, targeting high-profile clients that admitted to selling Perry 25 vials of ketamine for $6,000 in the days leading up to his death. Perry's stepfather, the TV journalist Keith Morrison, said he felt badly for the Shanga family.
This is a very fair judge, and she considered the case very carefully and delivered a highly reasoned sentence. So, I feel... We miss Matthew dreadfully, of course, and I feel bad for the family of the perpetrator here as well. Nobody won today.
In Times 2 this morning, a story that goes back to the stars of 70s TV.
Once upon a time, there were three little girls who went to the police academy.
Shane Watson writes about a reunion of the three stars of Charlie's Angels, Kate Jackson, Jacqueline Smith and Cheryl Ladd. They're now aged between 74 and 80, and they look amazing in that very sort of Hollywood way. In a very Hollywood way. Shane says they show the division between those who think plastic surgery is the way to keep looking good and those who think it's awful.
It's a fun piece. He says, spot the difference 50 years on. They do look amazing, but in different ways. you have to different? Look at the photograph yourself to hear. Go, Callum.
Yeah,
I think it's the plastic surgery when you can tell you've had it. I think it then for hasn't worked.
But you always can, can't you?
Well, I don't know. Maybe people have had tweakments that you're not aware of, Callum. I'm not speaking on behalf of myself. moving on. 22 minutes past six. Munchausen syndrome by proxy is a mental illness where parents make up illnesses for their children. Vets are now warning similar behaviour is happening with people's pets. We'll get more on that next. This is Times Radio Breakfast with Callum McDonald and Rosie Wright in association with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Ed Vasey on Times Radio, reviewing the week in politics from Westminster and beyond.
This is the kind of most interesting thing, I guess, about what is going on in British politics at the moment.
The daily political debrief with a difference.
Oh no, more crypto-commie pro-Labour Vasey.
Plus a peerless lineup of guests and commentators.
He, like me, and indeed like most of our listeners, is a bit of a political junkie.
Ed Vasey, tomorrow morning from 10 on Times Radio.
Listeners, we interrupt the airwaves to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house,
and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly.
To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Everywhere Nationwide has a branch, it promises to still be there until at least the start of 2030. For verification, visit nationwide.co.uk/ourpromise.
24 minutes past six, the Times this morning reports that pet owners are falsely claiming their animals are sick or even making them ill to get attention for themselves. A study has found that some owners exhibit a form of Munchausen syndrome by proxy involving their pets in order to gain sympathy from vets. It's a mental health condition where a person fakes illness in a loved one for attention. We're joining us now is Professor Andrew Knight, veterinary professor of animal welfare. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning.
Have you come across this?
You know, that's really hard to say. When I worked in veterinary clinical practice for around a decade, we'd have a certain proportion of the cases would come in that, where the animals weren't actually unwell. But usually that was because people were just wanting to check and make sure that there was nothing really wrong with their animals. There'd been some kind of variation in sleep patterns or appetite or some unusual behaviour, and they were just taking extra care. Situations where people are actually falsifying the story of what's going on with their animal are probably extremely rare, thankfully. But it's much more common for people to come in with animals that are hardly unwell and they just want to be sure that there's nothing more serious going on.
Yeah, they want reassurance rather than sort of the attention seeking that Munchausen can elicit. Does it suggest there is some sort of professional responsibility on the vet to work out, is this someone who's simply sort of overly anxious or someone who's falsifying symptoms?
Absolutely. I think this is so interesting because this is the first time really that one of the very first times that we've been made aware that perhaps some people might be falsifying, exaggerating or even inducing illnesses in their animals. Whilst it's very common that we see animals that are hardly unwell, it's believed to occur in about 10 to 30% of visits to veterinarians. It's not been on our radar to think that perhaps a very small proportion of these clients might actually be making up stories about what's going on with their animals. And that is a real concern because if veterinarians make incorrect diagnoses, put animals through unwarranted diagnostic procedures, and perhaps give unnecessary treatments, and that's something that can actually affect the welfare of animals. So it does need to be on the radar of vets. So I'm glad this story's come out.
Yeah, some of the things that have been identified, it's pretty awful, and poisoning, interference with surgical sites, or I guess this is the biggest indicator of what's been going wrong, animals showing signs of rapid recovery once they're separated from their owners.
Yes, and that's something that we can and some quite often do is we admit animals for observation for a day or a couple of days in order to get a closer idea of what's going on. If those animals mysteriously get much better when they're in the veterinary clinic, then it certainly does raise those sorts of concerns that perhaps there might be something going on at home that's actually contributing to those illnesses. I think animals are particularly vulnerable in this way. We've known that this can be a problem with people that suffer from Munchausen by proxy when they're taking care of children or elderly people or other vulnerable people, and they sort of people with mental health problems or personality disorders and have a sort of pathological need for attention, validation and sympathy from medical professionals, they might be inducing these sorts of illnesses in children. This is a very rare condition, but it does happen, unfortunately. At least children have a little bit more capacity to speak up for themselves and alert medical professionals to the fact that there might be something going on. I think animals are particularly vulnerable because they don't have the capacity to pick up a phone, call a number, talk to others. They're really very much dependent on us, so they're particularly vulnerable to this sort of abuse, so it does need to be on the radar of vets.
Yeah, and I think with children as well, they are vulnerable to believing, of course, what their parents tell them, or vulnerable to manipulation. It does also suggest that the person who needs help is obviously then not the pet who maybe in the short term needs the medical attention, but the person who owns the pet. I mean, if a vet suspects this is happening, what then is the right protocol?
The vet's primary responsibility is certainly the welfare of the animal under their care. So if they suspected grounds for abuse, they would need to be contacting authorities such as the RSPCA. But there's an additional point that you've rightly made, that concern for the people themselves. And animal abuse by falsification would be an example of a mental health and a personality disorder. We are very careful about sharing any confidential details about animals and clients with anybody else without client's permission. But if there are genuine grounds for feeling that a person is at risk or a person really needs help, then the first thing to do, I think, would be to contact the Royal College of Veterinary Surgeons and get their advice about where to refer to the case to and whether the bar for violating client confidentiality has been met by the seriousness of the circumstances. If that's true, then probably a referral to social services would be in order, but it would be something that would need to be carefully considered.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Professor Andrew Knight, the Veterinary Professor of Animal Welfare, on that story inside the Times today.
Do stay with us on Times Radio Breakfast as we assess the fragility of the ceasefire in the Middle East and, I suppose, what it means for negotiations, which are due to begin in Pakistan tomorrow. J.D. Vance, the US Vice President, will be there. I'm quite struck, actually, by a line from Newt Gingrich, a former House Speaker, who is close to President Trump in the US, of course. This is what he said. "My number one concern right now is to see over the next 4 to 6 weeks whether we lied to ourselves because we lost our nerve or whether we got a real agreement with real teeth that involves real change." And I think that is actually very much the backdrop for all of our conversations today on the programme, including with the Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, who will join us in about half an hour from now at 7 o'clock. We will bring you your morning briefing, your daily briefing on the day's politics, business and sports headlines. After the news, here's Stuart Willie.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Callum, thank you. Good morning. The price of oil rose again overnight amid reports Tehran is not allowing ships through the Strait of Hormuz. It says Iran's Revolutionary Guards threaten a regretful response to Israel's heavy bombardment of Lebanon yesterday. Officials in Beirut say more than 250 people were killed. Israel says its operation against Hezbollah did not fall under the temporary ceasefire announced by Donald Trump and insists the conflict is not over. Mark Laity, a former NATO special advisor, says Mr. Trump is unlikely to accept Israel putting the agreement at risk.
I don't think he's taking it that seriously now, but I think if it threatens a ceasefire and he wants the ceasefire to continue, he'll take it a lot more seriously. And he says to Netanyahu, stop. I don't think Netanyahu will have any choice but to stop.
Meanwhile, in a Truth Social post, Donald Trump has warned that the US will restart its assault if any part of the agreement is breached. Victims and bereaved families in England and Wales are to be allowed more time to challenge sentences they think are too lenient. Reforms will mean they'll have more chances to ask for public interest cases to be referred to the Court of Appeal. The RSPCA has denied a photograph showing dozens of dogs crammed in a living room was created using AI. More than 250 poodle cross animals were found together earlier this year. And in the Champions League, Liverpool suffered a 2-0 defeat to Paris Saint-Germain in the first leg of their quarter-final. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
All right, we've got Simon on the line. Simon, young people, they're just all a bit lazy, aren't they?
What are you for?
McDonald's.
Can I get 6 minutes, please?
Some say young people are work shy, but at McDonald's, we hired 47,000 of them last year.
Very much. So, how's your night?
Like George here, who keeps things running during a Friday rush. Resilience, making it happen at McDonald's.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Members don't just bank with them, they own them.
Good morning. We're so glad to be with you on Times Radio Breakfast. It's Rosie Wright and Callum MacDonald. Our home on Times Radio is on Friday, Saturday and Sunday breakfast. But this week we're covering for Kate McCann and Stig Abel, who are on their holidays, their Easter holidays. They'll be back on Monday. Rosie's here over the weekend. I'm ducking out at 10 o'clock.
Because you're moving house.
Oh, I'm moving house. It's
a
busy,
good enough excuse.
It's a busy old time. But yes, thank you so much for spending the morning with us. Coming up then, Yvette Cooper, the Foreign Secretary, just after 7 o'clock. And the Shadow Foreign Secretary, Dame Priti Patel, is with us at 7:45 as well, as we try to assess what is going on in the Middle East, when is a ceasefire not a ceasefire, and what is the progress, really, of Sir Keir Starmer's trip to the region as well, which continues today. After 8 o'clock, we'll be speaking to the former British ambassador to the US, that's Sir Peter Westmacott. And we'll get the best letters to the Times at 8:25, which usually I love listening to, and today we get to do it out loud. So we'll be doing that with with Andrew Riley at 25 past eight. We've got a debate for you on the triple lock on pensions. You may have benefited from the triple lock even in the last few days if the state pension's gone up for you. So we'll be debating the merits or otherwise of that at 8:30. And after nine, we've got A.N. Wilson, the historian, and journalist Muriel Zaga to discuss the day's headlines and issues and all the things that we learn as we go through the morning together on Times Radio Breakfast. Hugo Rifkind is on from 10. Joe Colburn presents the Times at one. And Asma Mir is sitting in for Jane Garvey and Fee Glover from 2 o'clock this afternoon.
Right now, it's time for our 6:35 briefing on the day's politics, business and sport. Politics first with the Times Politics newsletter editor, Stefan Boscher. Stefan, good morning.
Morning, Rosie.
So can we start with the Prime Minister's trip in the Gulf? So tell us, he arrived yesterday. What is he up to? The idea is sort of exercise some kind of influence on negotiations that are going to take place tomorrow. What are we imagining?
Yeah, so the PM saw Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi leader, yesterday, and he'll continue this tour over today and tomorrow. And while details about exactly who he's meeting has been kept tightly under wraps, you can expect it would be the major players in the region, particularly Qatar, for instance, who may make a trip to the UAE, maybe Oman. And he's the general thrust of the trip is he's trying to speak to these Middle Eastern leaders about a way forward in terms of opening up the strait and how to keep dialogue open between the Middle East and Europe at this time. But as you were sort of mentioning before there, I mean, it can't be, underestimated, the fact that Keir Starmer is essentially an observer for these negotiations on the sidelines. I mean, this is something that is being done completely through other intermediaries like Pakistan, for instance, and also China has had a big role in these negotiations so far between the US and Iran. So, I mean, Starmer's influence, it seems, was already quite low as his war began, and even lower now after weeks of attacks by Trump on the NATO alliance, particularly on Keir Starmer personally.
Yeah, well, exactly. We'll chart his visit over the next couple of days here. Of course, this is having big implications on all of our finances. Inflation's likely to rise. Rachel Reeves, though, the Chancellor, is going to try to resist pressure to give out higher pay rises.
Yeah, so inflation now, after the war, the new projections suggest there'll be 4% this year, which is double the Bank of England's target. And so already you have unions, particularly education unions, the BMA, the British Medical Association, and other public sector unions saying that the current pay, suggestions from the public service pay body are out of date because they're going on old information. So they're already calling for higher pay rises, above inflation pay rises, which Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, she doesn't want to get into a pay inflation. She doesn't want to get into a wage price spiral here. She doesn't want to get to a situation where wages have to increase to catch up with the runaway inflation, which then pushes inflation up higher. So it's a really difficult situation for her, and it's a very delicate situation. But you do get a feeling that with the government's sort of authority quite low, with the unions already unhappy with the direction of this Labour government, they may be well willing to go into, you know, protracted pay disputes and even industrial action, as we've already seen with the BMA over resident doctors.
Yeah, and the BMA may start looking at the payoff that was on the table and feel, so that number was pretty generous compared to what other people in the public sector are being offered. There's a big story in the paper today from Matt Dathan, the Home Affairs editor, about this. We know there's an agreement in place, which has sort of a multi-million pound price tag on it, between the French and the UK about the French's responsibility to try to intercept and stop small boats. And the renegotiation of that deal has been pushed back by a couple of months. We are learning now, though, that the French rejected a British offer to have British boats intercepting and returning small boats in French waters. What went wrong here?
Yeah, it seems that the French are being really intransigent in these negotiations. They first said that they didn't want any expansion of French authorities stopping boats in shallow waters. They don't want any sort of sense of any of the payments that go from the UK to France being linked on performance or linked on how many boats actually get stopped or how many boats are coming over. And now, as you say, we hear that they're also against the UK having their own boats in French waters to do this. So it does seem that there's a real deadlock here between any sort of deal going forward. And I think what's happened is Shibanamu has seen the last 3 years of this deal struck by Rishi Sunak. She's seen that there hasn't actually done anything really to stop the number of boats coming to this country. And clearly she wants some actual new terms to ensure that the deal works. So How this one gets solved, I have to imagine it will have to be at the leaders' level, and have to be between Starmer and Macron directly.
Yeah, there's sort of some suggestion that payment could be given only if a percentage of migrants attempting to leave France to get on boats could be intercepted, a sort of interception rate.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is what Shabana Mahmood wants. She wants a situation where the money only goes from the UK to France if you actually see real results here. And I think the French authorities, like, their argument for not doing it is they say that this would lead to risky behaviours from police officers and other naval authorities, and it would lead French authorities to then be putting lives in danger because they would be taking more risky steps to try to stop these boats. Now, as you expect, Shabana Moon Home Office thinks this is complete dross, and it's just an excuse not to actually put more patrols on and to not actually use the resources they've been given. So it's definitely a deadlock, which looks very difficult to break.
Yeah, absolutely. Finally, we are less than a month away now from the local elections. The Greens launched their local election campaign today. How much do you think they are posing right now a real threat to Labour?
I think in London, in places like London, they're a massive threat. If you look at a lot of the sort of inner London boroughs like Hackney, Islington, for instance, areas where Jeremy Corbyn did really well and was really popular, particularly in the 2019-2017 elections, those areas with young progressive voters, I think, are a real risk of those councils falling to the Green Party at this election. And I think that you could very well see a narrative, and you probably will see a narrative after the locals on May 7, where Labour are squeezed from all sides and they lose completely, have the bottom fall out of their left-wing vote in places like London and Greater Manchester, while also losing the white working class vote in reform areas in, for instance, Sunderland, and also in Scotland and Wales. So I think that this is a real threat to them from the Green Party. And, you know, what Zach Blansky's talking about today is he's coming out with a very populist pitch on housing, talking about a great increase in social housing building under a Green Party, but also about capping rents, about rent controls in London, which is something which I think will go very well with a lot of young people who have been hit by very high rents for a very long time.
Yeah, I can imagine. Stefan, thank you very much. Stefan Boscher, the politics newsletter editor at The Times. You can read Stefan's newsletter every day at 9 a.m. If you are a subscriber, of course, go to your Times account and click newsletters.
6:41 now. What are subscribers reading on thetimes.com and the Times app this morning?
Third most read.
Primrose Hill stabbings. Video director, aged 21, killed in North London Park.
This is a budding filmmaker, Finbar Sullivan, who was attacked and killed on Tuesday evening. A friend of the family said Finbar just went to the park to enjoy this beautiful day. She described him as a very gentle, soft-spoken, polite, well-mannered boy. Everyone loves him.
In second place,
Diana's lady-in-waiting given catastrophic driving ban for speeding.
Anne Beckwith-Smith had told a court that it would be catastrophic to be banned from driving after repeated speeding offences. She said she needed her car to visit her unwell brother, but the prosecution pointed out that she also owned a second property near to him.
And the article you're reading most this morning?
Iran war latest.
Inevitably, perhaps. Lots of you are clicking on the Times live blog on the war this morning. The latest post is about how Iran may have put mines into the Strait of Hormuz. All the latest on the war is there for you now, and we'll be across this programme too.
Let's continue our daily briefing for you. We'll move on to business news with business journalist Adam Shaw. Morning, Adam.
Good morning.
We've been watching oil prices and stock markets particularly closely since the war in Iran began. Just talk to us about the impact of the announcement of a ceasefire and what's happened since.
Well, 24 hours is a very long time in the markets. I think fair to describe this period of trading as something like a whiplash market, which is as predictable and perhaps better as constant as the British weather. As we went to bed, global equity markets had rebounded. Oil prices had fallen back below $95 because of this tentative peace promise in the Middle East. In fact, the FTSE 100 climbed 2.5% yesterday, its biggest rise since April last year. But a new day, it's barely begun, and it's a new story. We've now got oil back above $97 in Japan, so the market is ahead of us there because of the time difference. It is flagging the way European markets are going to open in a few hours. The market rose yesterday. It's now down around 400 points. And this really sets the scene for some poor results when the market opens in the UK later this morning. The problem is, this is a yo-yo market. It is very difficult to call. And it speaks of a wider issue here, a really interesting piece of research, which talks about these sorts of historical volatile times, when you should invest and when you shouldn't invest. And it's very tempting for people to go, oh, it's very nervous, let's get out of the market and let's come back in. JP Morgan did a famous study which said that actually if you missed just the five best days in the stock market, the five, just 5 days, your return would have been cut in half. Had you missed the best 10 days over the year, you actually would have lost money. And it goes to this idea that this is time, not timing in the market. You admit it really, especially now, given that anything can happen when Donald Trump wakes up in the morning. You don't know where the market is going. For long-term investors, you really might want to stay in the market, would this sort of research would suggest, because you just don't know what's going to happen. And over long term, the market is still up. And amidst all these headlines, we should remember that despite the fact we're talking about the market collapsing, the FTSE is up 34% in the past year, even given the recent falls. So we should set our worries in that sort of context.
Yeah, and just on that, on the idea of investing and I suppose that level of reassurance there, there is a government-backed review which is suggesting that, risk warnings to potential investors should actually be toned down. Explain more about this, because there is a push for so-called retail investing on the way, isn't there?
Yes, so this is from the Financial Conduct Authority. The city regulator asked the Investment Association, the trade body, to look into this. This was after the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, in July, ordered them to review these risk warnings. And the issue here is that you'll often hear in adverts and read them that says, quote, your capital is at risk, the value of investments can fall as well as rise. And the research showed that around 38% of people found that the phrase capital at risk meant that they felt they could lose everything. And the idea is, well, you want to redress that because in the long term, investments tend to go up. I understand that. I think, however, whereas it sounds very good, I don't know if you're an investor, but many people who might be investors will get an unbelievable amount of paperwork from their advisors and from the stock markets and from the funds they're in, because they've been told to issue all this stuff. And just changing the wording, actually, I'm not sure how effective that is, because what I find is happening is that you're deluged with so much paperwork, you actually don't read any of it anyway. Yeah. So adding different changes to a couple of words, I'm not sure how effective that is, but it's right, kind of. It goes to that point, which is the point they're trying to make, is that generally, over the long term, stock markets tend to rise.
Yes. Right, let's go on, because the Bank of England has been talking to retailers and a third of them say surge pricing will happen this year. I think surge pricing became sort of a household name, as it were, when Oasis were selling tickets to their tour, this idea of dynamic pricing and the controversy it causes. But now there's a suggestion this could happen in shops and supermarkets. Just talk to us about how it could work.
Yes, so one of the big problems for supermarkets is sort of rather, feels like Stone Age sort of technology, is that when Sainsbury's or Tesco want to change the price of something, literally thousands of people around the country have to go to the shelf and replace a little sticker with a new sticker. If you're doing that thousands of times, that is quite expensive. It's called menu costs. And actually what they're doing is moving to more digital pricing. So you have a little LCD display and someone at head office changes the price of milk or bread or baked beans and it happens automatically. Lovely, nice and efficient, should reduce the cost of all these things. What the Bank of England is saying is that, aha, but this also enables them to actually change the price every minute. So just for instance, as yesterday the weather got hotter, maybe in the same way that people who buy their airline tickets just before the Easter holidays find it suddenly rises as everyone wants to buy airline tickets to Spain, suddenly as everyone wants ice, maybe the supermarkets will increase the price of the ice just as you want it. So what you're seeing is this really problematic issue. And the question is, you know, is this helpful or is this another way of squeezing consumers? I think there's a logic in the likes of, when you say, Callum, Oasis, because there's a very limited number of tickets. And they would argue, well, we can sell some cheap ones, and as they run out, we raise the price. We're unlikely to run out of baked beans. so I tend to think the argument for dynamic pricing in the supermarkets is much less, and it's much more falling on the side of just trying to squeeze money out of consumers.
Yeah,
but we will see.
I also think it's also a bit artificial, because the issue is not necessarily the shelf, what is on the shelf. The issue would be for producers and manufacturers and costs rising. And that isn't that doesn't change by the minute in that context. So passing it on sort of by the minute or between breakfast and lunchtime feels a little bit, consumer loaded, I suppose.
I think you're absolutely right.
I will say, as somebody who used to have to do the pricing on supermarket shelves, it's an absolute pain in the neck putting those labels out, I will tell you that. Adam, thank you so much. Great to speak to you. We'll catch you again in 20 minutes, half an hour or so.
Thank you very much.
That is business journalist Adam Shaw. The paper tickets, awful. You used to have to peel back the plastic. It really hurts. You have to use your fingernail, so it really wears away under your fingernail. Anyway, those days are behind me for now, at least.
When I lived in France, actually, they had electronic pricing displays. And I hadn't thought, oh, right, maybe they're ratcheting up the price on a sunny day of my ice lollies or ice cream or whatever, but that's what could be looming for us.
I'm actually keen for you to join the conversation on dynamic pricing in supermarkets. Can you see the merit in it, or does it feel like it's a bit of an affront, actually? You can WhatsApp us on 0333 003 2353.
The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, joins us after 7 in just over 10 minutes' time. Next, we'll get an update on the sport and we'll remember this day in history. This is Times Radio Breakfast with Callum McDonald and Rosie Wright in association with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Weekends on Times Radio with Visit Scotland. Make Times Radio your essential weekend destination with intelligent conversation and incisive analysis of all the big stories making the headlines. Exploring the wider news agenda with the best journalists from The Times and The Sunday Times and high-profile guests from the worlds of politics, business, the arts and more. Weekends on Times Radio with Visit Scotland. Start your own Scottish story this spring. Search Visit Scotland Spring and plan your next adventure.
The day's big stories and tomorrow's front pages, Saturday and Sunday nights from 10 p.m. with Daryl Morris.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows, and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and on your smart speaker. Times Radio Breakfast.
And continuing our daily briefing, the sports news. Will Hobbs from TalkSport is in the studio. Will, good morning.
Good morning.
So the English clubs looked so good in the group stage of the Champions League, but now at the business end, they're not looking so dominant. Shall we start with Liverpool losing to Paris Saint-Germain? The back page of the Times just says Liverpool outclassed.
Yeah, that's a good summary of last night. Liverpool, the English champions against the French champions PSG, and obviously the Champions League winners from last season. PSG, unlike the English clubs who, as you say, dominated the group stage of the Champions League where six teams were in the top eight, they were really slow in the group stages. They lost to Sporting Lisbon, they lost to Bayern Munich as well. They had to get to the knockouts via a playoff, which they squeezed through. And then when it came to the business end, they played Chelsea. They beat them 8-2 on aggregate. And yesterday was very one-sided against Liverpool. 73% possession. It's just 2-0 going into the second leg at Anfield. So Arne Slot thinks Liverpool are still in with a chance because Anfield is the stage historically for great European comebacks. In 2019, they were 3-0 down to Lionel Messi's Barcelona and still won the tie, won 4-0 on the night. But since then, they haven't won a knockout game in the Champions League at Anfield, and this season it doesn't look like they would do that again.
So you think maybe that's a healthy helping of wishful thinking?
That is, yeah, a good dollop of wishful thinking from a man who's very much under pressure. He won the Premier League in his first season at Liverpool. This season has been a bit of a car crash. He broke transfer records in the summer. That hasn't delivered, that hasn't come to fruition. His big money striker has been injured all season. In November, they had their worst losing run since the 1950s, and he's under real pressure because because if they don't qualify for the Champions League, which is nip and tuck, they're just 1 point inside the top five, which will be enough, then the man who won the Premier League in his first season at the club could be out of a job come the summer.
OK, let's move on then to Arsenal. They are, though, still in a good position.
Yes, they are. So they won on Tuesday night against Sporting Lisbon. That was significant because Sporting hadn't lost in 23 home matches in Lisbon. They'd beaten PSG before that as well, beaten Barcelona. So Arsenal are still flying the flag, and they should get through to the semi-finals because their second leg is obviously at the Emirates, and they've got that one goal cushion. So Arsenal seemingly flying the flag after Chelsea bombed out last round, and Man City did as well.
Okay. Golf and the US Masters start. The Times has got some coverage.
Yeah, big coverage. Rick Broadbent leading the line, as he always does. Tom Kershaw with a lovely piece as well, because Augusta National is such a unique place. It's like Wimbledon for golf, given the history, given the rules around the course as well. No phones, no running. So what you get at 7 a.m. each day is sort of crowds of middle-aged men, and they break through and they start waddling and race walking to the club shop. The race to the shop is significant because you can't buy any Masters gear outside the ground. So it's calculated that the club shop takes in around £50 million during the tournament. Wow. And a lot of it is spent on gnomes. The Masters gnome, they're only a foot high. Garden gnomes at the Masters, they go for $60. And they're very sought after indeed. It's pretty bizarre. But yeah, the Times' is Tom Kershaw saying, like molecules in a bottle of fizzy drink, the fans gather at the gates at 7 a.m. and start waddling over. But it is such a unique place, the Masters. It's unfettered history, described as the Truman Show with azaleas by Rick Broadbent, and anyone could win it this year. Rory McIlroy, of course, won last year. He ended his 11-year major drought and won the career Grand Slam in unbelievable fashion, and in the playoff with Justin Rose, who's in it again. Scottie Scheffler, world number one. If he's on form, he's usually the favourite, but he's not hitting his height. Bryson DeChambeau's in the mix as well. It's always dramatic, and it usually comes down right to the wire.
Yeah, it's a brilliant piece in the Times that says, forget statistics, this year it is anyone's.
Yeah, I think so. John Rahm in there as well. Ludvig Åberg is always sort of in the top two or three in the last couple of years. That green jacket is so fated. There is nothing like it in the sport.
And the dark horse, according to the Times, Patrick Reed. So lots to watch and lots to play for. Will, thank you very much. Will Hobbs, the reporter from TalkSport, thank you so much.
Two things. I've looked up the Masters gnomes. They are weird, as all gnomes are, can confirm.
But gnomes are back at the Chelsea Flower Show this year.
Yeah,
apparently the King is a fan.
And they'll be weird there too. And the other thing is, do you ever worry that you are the star of your own Truman Show and just nobody's told you?
No.
Because they're not allowed to tell you.
No.
It's a thought that festers in my mind every so often. What if nobody's told me?
This is your opportunity to tell Callum if you'd like to break cover.
Don't burst the bubble, but you may be the star of your own Truman Show and no one's told you. We're all just watching you. Right, 6:56, time now for our radio version of the Times on this day feature. It is the 9th of April, and in 1940, Nazi Germany launched simultaneous invasions of the neutral nations of Denmark and Norway. Hitler's surprise invasion forced the Norwegian royal family to flee, along with the nation's entire gold reserves, just hours before German troops reached Oslo. The British responded with then First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill, launching a disastrous campaign in Scandinavia. The failings ultimately led to the resignation of the Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain and to Winston Churchill taking over as PM.
On this day in 2005, Prince Charles, as he was known then, married Camilla Parker Bowles in a civil ceremony at Windsor Guildhall. It made the future king the first member of the British royal family to marry in a civil rather than a religious ceremony. Well, as you can hear, the couple were greeted by large crowds, many of them whooping, and accompanied by Prince William and Prince Harry. They were then driven to their blessing that took place in St. George's Chapel in a Rolls Royce.
On this day, the 9th of April in 1969, the British-built prototype of Concorde made its maiden flight from Filton to Fairford, which of course paved the way for supersonic commercial travel across the Atlantic for decades, until lower passenger numbers and high operating costs saw Concorde's last flight in 2003. But if you miss this sound... how could you not? The US are now working on Concorde 2.0, which will use 100% sustainable fuel with the aim of commercial flights taking off from New York to London from 2027.
And on this day in 1970, Paul McCartney shocked the world when he in effect revealed he was leaving the Beatles in an interview promoting his solo album. McCartney interviewed himself, asking his own questions about his relationship with John Lennon. He asked himself if a new Beatles album was in the works and answered, no. The opening track, Maybe I'm Amazed, from the album, sees McCartney express gratitude to his wife Linda during this tumultuous time in the singer's life. Maybe I'm a man, maybe I'm a lonely man who's in the middle of something that he doesn't really understand. Oh, maybe I'm a man, maybe you're the only woman who can ever help me. Maybe won't you help me to understand? Ooh. That's Maybe I'm Amazed. Excellent lyrics, actually.
Yeah, very nice, to be fair. I don't think I've heard that before, in honesty. I'm not a massive Beatles fan, but I quite enjoyed that. Right, there we are. Stay with us. Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper's on the way in the next couple of minutes.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good morning, it is 7 o'clock. This is Rosie Wright and Callum McDonald with Times Radio Breakfast.
Good morning, the headlines. Vice President Vance says Iran should not let peace negotiations fall apart over a misunderstanding. And the Bank of England says many shops will introduce surge pricing in the coming months.
Ahead, the Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper will give us the UK government's assessment of the fragile ceasefire in the Gulf and why the French have said no to Shabana Mahmood's offer to help them stop the boats.
It is Thursday, the 9th of April.
This is Times Radio.
First with the news, here's Stuart Willie.
Rosie, thank you. Good morning. The American vice president is urging Iran not to let peace talks collapse over what he called a misunderstanding. Tehran says it may not take part after Israeli strikes on Lebanon yesterday killed more than 250 people. The United States insists an end to Israeli attacks on Lebanon was never part of the truce agreement, but Iran's president says it's an essential part of the deal. Oil prices have risen again as Iran says the Strait of Hormuz will now remain closed. J.D. Vance is due to lead the U.S. delegation in Islamabad for talks on Saturday.
I encourage the Iranians to come to the table seriously. We've seen some signs that they're going to do that. We've seen some signs of bravado. Fundamentally, we're in a good spot. They're reopening the straits. We have a ceasefire. And frankly, if they break their end of the bargain, then they're going to see some serious consequences.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump says military ships, aircraft and troops will stay in the region until the deal is fully complied with, warning that US forces could resume the assault if it's not. He also criticised NATO after meeting its Secretary General in Washington, saying it wasn't there when we needed them and won't be there if we need them again. The Wall Street Journal reports Mr. Trump is considering punishing some allies for not doing enough to help the United States or Israel in the conflict. NATO head Mark Rutte told CNN their discussion was frank and open, and he flagged UK efforts to reopen the Strait of Hormuz.
He is clearly disappointed with many NATO allies, and I can see his point. But at the same time, I was also able to point to the fact that the large majority of European nations has been helpful with basing, with logistics, with overflights. Hey, and let's not forget, there's Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, who is bringing together now a coalition of over 30 countries, even over 40.
The Bank of England says shoppers are likely to see more dynamic pricing in stores this year, with costs changing throughout the day depending on demand. It says one in three retailers plan to use what it calls market-responsive pricing tools, allowing prices to be adjusted using algorithms and electronic shelf displays. Campaigners fear that could lead to surge pricing and are calling for tighter regulation of the grocery sector. Here's business journalist Adam Shaw.
This also enables to actually change the price
every minute. So just for instance, as yesterday the weather got hotter, the supermarkets will increase the price of the ice just as you want it. So what you're seeing is this really problematic issue. And the question is, you know, is this helpful or is this another way of squeezing consumers?
And the dress Queen Elizabeth II's stunt double wore to skydive into the Olympic Stadium as part of an exhibition showcasing her clothes. The late monarch's trademark headscarves, tweed suits and lavish ball gowns are also going to be featured in the sold-out show at Buckingham Palace from tomorrow. For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times Radio news briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online and on your smart speaker. Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide.
And it's 4 minutes past seven. The Foreign Secretary is making her annual Mansion House speech tonight. She'll say how important freedom of navigation is, especially having oil tankers having the freedom to navigate the Strait of Hormuz. But Iran wants to charge tolls on ships going through the strait to pay for the damage inflicted on it by America and Israel. And Donald Trump has even suggested the US might take a cut after the war is over. The Foreign Secretary, Yvette Cooper, joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Rosie.
How would you describe the status of the ceasefire this morning?
Well, look, it's welcome that this ceasefire is in place. Obviously, there's talk of the fragility of it, but really we want it to succeed and we want the negotiations to succeed. We were not involved in the start of this conflict, but we will work to support bringing it to a sustainable end. And as you said in the introduction, for UK interests, that means getting the Strait of Hormuz open again. And that is what we are working with countries across the world to maintain the pressure for that to be fully open. It's an international shipping route and we cannot have any one country hijacking international shipping routes like that in order to hold the global economy hostage.
Would you describe the ceasefire as fragile?
So, look, we get different mixed reports and it has only just started. One of the things I do feel very strongly about is we want to see Lebanon included in the ceasefire. We want it extended to cover Lebanon because otherwise that will destabilise the whole region still. And also it's just the right thing to do.
I mean, Lebanon is currently coming under fire. Yeah. Yesterday, the worst of the conflict so far.
Exactly. And I think that escalation that we saw from Israel yesterday, I think, was deeply damaging. And we want to see an end to hostilities in Lebanon. That does mean dealing with the threat from Hezbollah that is an Iranian proxy, has been a terrorist organization. And it is really important that the Israeli government and the Lebanese government can work together to deal with that threat from Hezbollah. But we don't want to see escalation. We want to see the ceasefire and the end to hostilities cover Lebanon as well.
Is the ceasefire credible if Lebanon isn't included?
So I think, look, it's important the progress that has been made so far, and we want to build on that progress. We want to see more progress made, and we want to see the further negotiations get underway as well. Look, there's a range of broader things taking place across the Middle East. As I said, the most significant for the wider economy, obviously, is the Strait of Hormuz. We haven't yet seen the progress there in getting that open. And that's why I'll be meeting with the International Maritime Organization later today. They have put forward proposals about how to start getting the Strait moving by starting to move some of the trapped ships, the trapped seafarers that are currently stuck in the Strait. That is putting environmental risk as well as economic risk by not getting those ships moving.
Yeah, there's a challenge here. You're saying that freedom of navigation means navigation must be free. I mean, that's a tautology. How do you stop Iran charging shipping tolls if America says they can?
Yeah, we're very strongly clear that there should be no tolls, there should be no charges. It's an international shipping route. It's between the high seas. This is part of the UN international, the law of the sea, that there should not be charges. And this is the trading route for Qatar, for Kuwait, for Bahrain, for countries across the Gulf. It's not just about the waters for Iran. And so, therefore, that international shipping should be supported. We don't don't take this view on the Dover Straits or the Gibraltar Straits or other shipping straits across the world, because these are international transit routes.
But if the US president is happy to impose tolls, what can the UK government do to prevent him do that?
Well, in fact, I've had many conversations with people across the US administration and also heard the president say that actually the Iran cannot introduce tolls. But that's why we want to maintain the pressure up on this. And it's why the UK convened 40 countries from every continent across the world to maintain that diplomatic pressure, that international pressure on freedom of navigation, but freedom of navigation not simply being the ability to pass, but only if you pay tolls, but actually free navigation, not just freedom of navigation. That is crucial to the global economy and to our interests, the work that we are doing to support tackle pressures on the cost of living back here at home.
Those allies include the US. How much has the NATO alliance been damaged? Yesterday, Trump on NATO said of his allies, that includes us, they were tested and they failed. Donald Trump again has been discussing the possibility of the US pulling out of NATO. How much damage has been inflicted on that alliance?
Well, let me say a couple of things about that. First of all, the NATO alliance is a defensive alliance, and in fact, the only time in its history when Article 5 has been triggered was triggered by the US after the 9/11 attacks, and the UK and other European countries, other NATO countries came to the US assistance in the action that they took after 9/11, and rightly so, because that was an attack on a NATO country. We also continue to have Russian nuclear weapons, for example, that are pointed at the United States as well as at Europe. And in the same way that, you know, the US has been concerned about not allowing Iran to develop nuclear weapons, actually Russia already has nuclear weapons. And that's why NATO continues to be so important, and we will continue to strongly support it. But look, there is a separate question about this particular conflict, and the UK did take a different view from the US at the start of this conflict. We did not get drawn into offensive action against Iran as part of that conflict, and we took a different decision in the UK national interest and according to UK values. And that's our job. It's the US president's job to do what he thinks is the right thing to do in the US national interest, but it's in the UK Prime Minister's it's the UK Prime Minister's job, Keir Starmer's job, to take a calm, steady decision in the UK national interest.
Yeah. This has raised questions about our ability to defend ourselves. We only said the US could use our bases for defensive strikes after RAF Akrotiri was hit in Cyprus. Why couldn't we adequately defend it? What lessons have been learnt?
Well, so I don't think that's a sort of full description of actually what's happened. The reason that we didn't agree to basing support for the offensive strikes. What we did do was agree to support defensive operations to defend Gulf partners as well, who were facing reckless and indiscriminate attacks.
Why couldn't we defend
the Iranian
our own
regime?
Base?
But we did provide, and we provided pre-deployed, because of the rising regional tensions, we moved F-35s, we moved Typhoons, we moved aircraft to the region that have been flying defensive operations over the Eastern Mediterranean, over Cyprus, but also over Gulf partners as well. And that is immensely important, because that was the UK providing defensive support for our own assets and interests, but also for Gulf partners as well, when they came under attack. And we continue to do so. So RAF pilots have been doing really important action against drones and missile attacks in the region.
But I'm also looking at today a photograph on the front page of the Daily Telegraph this morning of Vladimir Putin sending a Russian warship alongside oil tankers sailing through the channel. The Prime Minister gave the Special Forces the authority to capture ships illegally ferrying oil to support the war in Ukraine if they sailed through British waters. Why have those vessels not been seized?
So we've seen increasing attempts over extended period of time from Russia to not just threaten Ukraine, not just the war in Ukraine, but also to threaten Europe, to threaten Europe more widely, and also to attempt to pose those kinds of threats to the UK as well. And we've seen attempt to do operations in the North Sea. We've seen the Shadow Fleet as well. So what the UK is now authorised is the ability to take action against against the shadow fleet. That is to make sure that we can enforce sanctions against Russia and Russia's oil and gas, and also make sure that our defensive operations are clear. It's why we are increasing our investment in defence with the biggest increase in defence investment since the Cold War, because we have to strengthen our own defence. One of the things I'm going to be saying in the speech I'm making tonight about UK foreign policy is not only can we not outsource our foreign policy decisions to other countries, but we also have to put security much more strongly at the heart of our foreign policy. And that means our national security is the way we're increasing investment in defence and in tackling hybrid threats. But it also means our economic security.
You are saying, because and I'm sorry to interrupt, we had that our can economic take security action. Being weaponized. And you haven't taken any action. No Russian vessel has been seized. Why not?
Well, those are all operational decisions in particular circumstances about what are the right decisions in those circumstances.
But
those
is a Russian warship not accompanying oil tankers through the channel, is that not exactly the type of the scenario where we should be intervening and seizing? Otherwise, what scenario would we be intervening in?
So I think it's right for decisions about individual operations to be taken through the Chief of Defence Staff and to be taken on a military basis.
And you think this didn't hit the threshold to intervene?
You would not expect me to comment on either individual operations or on that decision-making process, because that is rightly done in a proper professional way.
Yvette Cooper, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Secretary,
speaking to us as we have had news of that ceasefire in action for, well, over 24 hours now. Negotiations start in Pakistan tomorrow.
Yeah, interesting conversation there. I mean, it's difficult when you thread all of that together, this shadow fleet, this warship moving through the channel. We couldn't get a ship to Cyprus in time. That ship is now broken. When you thread all of that together, you look at the situation and go, right, hang on a second. Where does the UK stand when it comes to influencing anything about this ceasefire, influencing anything about reopening the Strait of Hormuz? And with the Prime Minister visiting the Gulf, where, by the way, the Arab oil states, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar, the UAE, Oman, they've all been exposed as vulnerable by Iran. And Iran's position of dominance has been absolutely secured because of its influence over the Strait of Hormuz. But when you look at the overall picture, where does the influence come from as far as the UK is concerned?
What Yvette Cooper will say is applying diplomatic international pressure. But that amounts to then what?
Mm.
If Donald Trump would like to take his own action and is doing so whilst being prepared to criticise in the most strong terms his allies, what levers of influence do we actually have to pull while the Prime Minister's in the region?
And that speaks to that desire that the Foreign Secretary has just expressed to you, that Lebanon must be included in this ceasefire, or she says there's a risk of destabilisation of the region. And in fact, she's called out the escalation from Israel in targeting Lebanon in the last 24 hours or so. She's called that deeply damaging. And so there is criticism in there. Is that enough to land with Israel and the US when it comes to trying to make this ceasefire work and make it sustainable?
And even if they hear the criticism, and the question will be, to what extent does that change Donald Trump's mind?
Mm.
Or Netanyahu's mind? I think probably not at all.
Yeah. So all of that on the table, I think, in these negotiations from tomorrow. And we'll keep an eye on the Prime Minister's trip around the Gulf as well this over the next couple of days. Your reaction and analysis is always a crucial part of the conversation. You can WhatsApp us 0333 003 2353. Lots more to come in the next few minutes on the conflict in Iran and where things stand. Let's bring you another business update now with business journalist Adam Shaw. Morning again, Adam.
Good morning.
Just a couple of numbers to get through. First of all, from the Japanese fashion brand Uniqlo reporting their results. How are they doing?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, Uniqlo, it's the company that owns it is called Fast Retailing. And although Uniqlo is its most famous brand, you might also know, I don't know how across fashion you are, Callum, but Goo, Theory, Comptoir, Des Cotonnières, I don't know, do you know any of those
Isn't
brands?
Goo the dessert people?
Yeah, no, it's not. Oh, I can see where your mind is going. It's those chocolatey, oozy desserts. This is a different sort of goo, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
But yes, you're right, Uniqlo is its most famous brand. An interesting thing about this is that it's spelled Uniqlo with a Q. That is because of a misspelling when the chap who went to register the company miswrote it down. It should have been Uniqlo, standing for Unique Clothing with a C. He misspelt it, and the chief executive quite liked it, so they kept it. anyway, so the whole company is there because of a misspelling. It's a very interesting business. It is fast retailing, but when we think of fast fashion, I think we often think of things like Zara, and Shine, who have built their empires on swiftly replicating runway styles at a fraction of the price. Uniqlo play a very different sort of game. They're sort of going for longevity. And I think that appeals to, to be honest, my personal experience is it appeals to a lot of blokes. I mean, I find myself, anyway, I go into a shop, clothes shop, and I tend to go, I'd like exactly what I'm wearing, please, but a newer version of that. And therefore, Uniqlo do those. They do those standards. They do a lot of thermal collections, and they've done very well. They've opened, I think, 23 stores in the UK. Their latest revenues prior to today announced revenues of more than 3 trillion yen. It's about 15 billion pounds. A 13% rise. It's really, really strong. And it's a really big part of the Japanese lifestyle. And shares have just rocketed up. Right. They are up 54% in a year. Extraordinary.
Absolutely extraordinary. Crucially as well, Adam, we've got a new report about how resilient our energy system and infrastructure actually is. What impact is solar and wind having?
It's a really interesting issue, this, because it touches on so many different things. It touches on the ecological debate about whether we should be moving to more cleaner power. But also, as you say, given the news today, it's very interesting in our strategic positioning. So the Iran war is important, is a big political gambit because of the oil around this. And despite the fact that people are dying and it feels awful to talk about the price of something as mundane as oil when families are being disrupted and many people are being killed. Nonetheless, it is clearly a driver. So removing the importance of that actually might make us more strategically stable. And there is a report out today from an energy think tank called Ember, which is saying that actually our increase in clean power has saved us £7 million a day because it's enabled us to move away from gas dependency. Gas prices have gone through the roof and it's driving down our carbon emissions. So politically, it's important and economically, it's important. And if you just step back, it is interesting to see how important wind and solar power have become. It's no longer the fringe thing it was just a few years ago. Reuters recently reported that it was over 52% of Britain's electricity generation in 2025. So this now has become a major part of our energy mix, important not just for our economy, but also for our political.